This episode is sponsored by Bible Bricks. They've created a brick building set of the Wilderness Sanctuary. Yep, the one from Exodus. With around 1,200 pieces, custom minifigs, and instructions that explain each part of the tabernacle as you build. Visit them at BibleBricks.com to learn more and maybe buy yourself a set.
How's it going, everyone? Welcome to Seeking What They Sought. I'm Jesse, and I'm here with Sean and Anthony, and we're here with Larry Garrity, who is a big figure in the local community that I'm part of, as the second president of La Sierra University, and currently the executive director of the La Sierra University Foundation. But also, if I'm correct, you have been in the field of archaeology. And scholarship and administrators. You've been all over the place in Adventist education. But you're here today because we wanted to have a conversation about your involvement in the formulation of the wording around the sanctuary doctrine in our 28 fundamental beliefs. And so before we get into all of that, just wanted to ask you, could you give a couple minute background to how you even get into that position?
Well, I'll say a little bit about my background. I grew up a missionary kid in China during World War II behind Japanese lines, and there until the communists came and foreigners had to leave. And my parents were transferred from China to Lebanon, where my dad was the president of Middle East University, a institution that was founded in 1939 by somebody who became my father-in-law. So my wife and I met as kids, grew up together in Lebanon, teenagers, I should say. And I got my interest in archaeology there at that time, watching people working in the field. And of course, growing up as an Adventist, knowing the Bible, and being interested in the historical background and how it helped to elucidate scripture and so forth. And while I was there, Siegfried Horn, who was a teacher at the seminary, came for his first visit to the Middle East. And as a teenager, I took him around, helped to host him, and thought, you know, someday it'd be fun to be an archaeologist, but how would I support myself? But anyway, I ended up at the seminary, taking all the courses that he taught. And then I got a call to Southeastern California Conference and started out in the ministry there, where I was colleagues with Sean's father. And I'd actually accepted a call to teach in Hong Kong, be a Bible teacher and a pastor. But the General Conference approached me as we were getting ready and said that Siegfried Horn wanted me to come and to succeed him at the seminary as an archaeology Old Testament teacher. And I said, no, I'd already waited. I mean, the Far Eastern Division was waiting for me, you know, and I'd accepted that call, and as much as I'd be interested, but I just had to honor my commitment. And the GC later came back to me and said, it would be easier to replace you in Hong Kong than to satisfy Dr. Horn. He's insistent that he wants to.
Wow.
I eventually decided to do that and went off, got my doctorate at Harvard in Syro-Palestinian archaeology and Hebrew Bible, and then began teaching at the seminary 1972, and it was there for 14 years.
Wow.
And it was during that time that the GC session 1980 took place, and somebody in the General Conference, I guess, decided that it would be good to review the fundamental beliefs statement and to draft a new one or edit what was available. And somebody got the idea, why don't we send what we've got here at the GC to the seminary and ask the professors there what they think of it. And I was part of the group that received that, and we all agreed that it needed a lot of help. And we thought that better start from scratch and do a new series of statements, because what was sent to us were all the peculiar views, I would say, of Adventism, but it was skewed. If you presented that to somebody who didn't know much about Adventists, it would look pretty kooky. You know, what about, don't we believe in the Bible? Don't we believe in, you know, the Godhead? Don't we believe in baptism? All these things were not addressed in a fully complete way. And so the dean appointed a committee of seminary professors, I being one of them, and Fritz Guy, who was teaching there at the same time and was the associate dean, he chaired that little committee. And so we divided up, we first of all decided on 27, the number 27, that was Fritz's number. And we covered the waterfront, what doctrines would be covered. And then we divided up those doctrines among several seminary professors. And so we drafted, and then we came together and edited each other's work and so forth, and sent it off to the General Conference, said we would suggest something like this. And they appreciated our work and said, you know, let's go with this. They made some changes and suggestions. And so the 1980 session of the GC, that was the complete agenda. I mean, starting with Monday morning and going through Friday, every morning, Neil Wilson, who was president at that time, presided, and they would discuss one doctrine after the other. And there were many statements made from the floor. You know, people would raise their hands and say, you know, what about this? What about that? We suggest something else. And so they were keeping a record of all these suggestions. Now what to do with them? And so Neil appointed a little committee of people that were supposed to review everything that was said on the floor and evaluate, could these be adapted? Could these be incorporated? Let's see if we have some good ideas, what ones to accept, what ones to reject. And I think there may have been 10 people appointed, and I was among those that were appointed to this little committee that sort of went in the backstage and would receive the suggestions from the floor, and we would reevaluate those. I should say, I guess, that the seminary at that time was given the opportunity to appoint one official delegate to the GC. And so the seminary faculty chose me for some reason. I still don't know. That's how I got to be. Really, in hindsight, I think Fritz Guy should have been the one they chose, because he's the theologian, which I'm not. I'm a historian, Old Testament exegesis person, and so on, but not a theologian. Anyway, and then after getting there, I was appointed to the small committee, you know, to evaluate what came up on the floor. And so most nights I would call Fritz and talk to him about what we were doing and get his suggestions and so on. So in a way he had input. And we worked our way through all the doctrines. The very last one to be evaluated and discussed was the sanctuary doctrine. And it was Friday morning.
Okay.
And we couldn't agree, this little group of 10 people, on wording, on the text that should be used, and so on. We're going back and forth.
And then Larry, can I interrupt you real quick? Curious, what would you say was the makeup? You said the committee was a combination of seminary professors. Was it all Andrews, or was it also?
No. It was made up of people that I presume Neil Wilson chose, but maybe he had wider choice. There were a couple of GC vice presidents. There was some theologians on there. I think Jim Landis was on the committee. And it was chaired by GC Vice President, Duncan Eva, I think, was the chair. So I would say that there was a combination of church leaders and maybe Bible teachers, and a couple of delegates from overseas. I don't think you'd call it a really representative group of the whole church, but it was, and I don't know how it was chosen, honestly, but that's who it was. And it was around Friday noon, I think, and we got a little note from Neil Wilson, who was on the floor chairing the session. And he said, hurry up and send us, you know, the doctrine for voting, because the delegates are getting anxious. This is their last day. Some people want to go get ready for Sabbath. They need to shop before they leave on Sunday and so on and get their souvenirs. Classic. So hurry up, you know. And so Duncan Eva said, well, shall we go with what we've got? And there was silence. And so I remember saying, if you read the text that are listed here, could we come up with this doctrinal statement that we've got? And nobody answered that question. I waited a while. I said, I don't know if that bothers you, but it bothers me. I don't know how we get this doctrine from these texts. And we discussed that for a while. But then Duncan Eva said, look, brethren, we've got to make a decision. The saints are getting antsy.
There's a time crunch.
Yeah, there's a time crunch.
Wow.
So Duncan said, we've got to have these phrases in there because we've had them for eons, and the saints will be unhappy if they don't hear these particular phrases. Right. So let's just go with what we've got. And so that's how we got that doctrine.
Interesting.
Really?
Wow.
Wow. So it was, wow.
Wow. And so now we have a whole podcast series on that's based off of this doctrinal statement, which was made on a time crunch on a Friday.
Wow.
I'm sure that's oversimplifying it, but it is a funny.
Right. And just to add to the chaos of this, this was in summer of 1980, right, Larry?
Right, right.
And this was right in the peak of the crisis with Desmond Ford.
Oh, true.
That's true.
So
it makes sense why there was a time crunch.
Yeah. Would you say that, Larry, this was, it almost feels like the way that you paint this, that this was a rushed process, that there should have been more deliberation, maybe even a follow-up, and maybe you can talk about the aftermath of this moment, but it just feels like this was such a significant, you know, this is a fundamental belief that we're publishing as doctrine. And I know that this might be a separate conversation, is how do we treat the fundamental beliefs? Are they our creed? Are they a measure for employment? And whether or not we agree on that, the reality is in practice, that's true. If I were to state publicly, and we had conversations with people about this, if I state publicly as an Adventist employee, whether a teacher or pastor, that I fully reject one of the fundamental beliefs, I'd probably be fired from my position. So whether or not, you know, people say, oh, it's not a creed or not, in practice, it is a measurement for employment, probably membership in most, you know, as a member in good standing in most Adventist churches. It's just wild to me the way that you described this process for the sanctuary doctrine, and just considering also the chaos of what happened with Desmond Ford, the division, many people leaving the church over that teaching. And then you have this. Do you feel like what happened here, GC 1980, contributed to that division? It caused further chaos, or was it just, you know, a side matter, regardless of what happened with Desmond Ford?
Well, I wouldn't say that what happened to the GC caused the problem. I think the problem existed. Mm-hmm. and that what went on at GC was part of it, and it was not resolved there. And so people came to the Glacier View committee, of which I was also a part, with their own views, you know, which had not been adequately aired or discussed or decided on, I don't think, you know. So it was a very consequential summer. And you're right that the statement of beliefs, as they began, you know, back in the 30s, I guess, and so on, and the subsequent iterations, were primarily designed to help people who were not Adventists understand what we believe. You know, people would say, what do Adventists believe? And so the Brethren felt, we need a statement that shares that.
Yeah.
It was never thought or designed to be something that was employees' views needed to be measured against it. You know, it was an outward kind of thing to help people who are not Adventists understand. So they have come to be used in the manner that you've mentioned, Sean, but that was not the original intent.
Interesting.
The current administration of the church has begun to use it in that way to evaluate employees' beliefs and whether they should be employed and so on. But that was never the intent.
Yeah.
Because our pioneers left their various churches in New England because of their creeds. And they never wanted a creed. That was something they were trying to get away from. So it was only much later, at least, you know, 50, 60 years later, when people needed a statement of what Adventists believe for those who are not Adventists to help understand it.
Yeah.
Larry, did you, were in the room, right? You were, there's a song in the musical called Hamilton, where called the Room Where It Happened. And they were talking about some things that happened in the forming of the United States. And I almost get that sense here. Like, you were in the room when the fundamental beliefs were crafted, created. Did you get the sense that there was this feeling of urgency in the room? Like, oh, this crisis is happening with everything Ford is doing. We need to figure this out. We need to create language. Did you get a sense there was pressure from the top coming your way? Like, there needs to be an answer, or is that not the case at all?
Well, I mean, the president literally told them to hurry up.
He did.
Right.
He did. Yeah.
Okay.
Because this was the last thing that had to be voted before people disbanded for the weekend sessions, you know, and then that was, the business was over. This was just going to be, you know, Friday evening and Sabbath, the traditional spiritual feast, you know, before the delegates would leave Sunday morning. So it was urgent that we complete that process. And I mean, I think that everybody did their best they could under the circumstances. You know, there was no animosity. There was no, I mean, people were not angry. They all had their views of what ought to be included and not included and so on. And so each of us was able to speak to it. But we did, I felt like, come to an impasse that Friday afternoon, and nobody had a way to do it, say it better. And so we were sort of stuck with what we got.
So the sense in the room was, and sorry, Jesse, the sense in the room was, it sounds like this doesn't feel adequate to describe what we're trying to get at, but we're out of time.
That's exactly right.
I see.
So, and was there, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, Larry, what were some of the things that were under discussion in the wording or different expressions? Was it anything, was it pretty major things that would have, that would shape how people look at the belief later on? Or was it fairly minor words or wordings?
you know, I think there were important wordings, but my main feeling was, how can we get this statement out of these texts from Daniel, Hebrews, and so on? You know, how did we come up with 1844 and the investigative judgment? And
you're saying that the statement doesn't account for hermeneutics or interpretation,
right?
Is that what you're saying?
Right. I mean, if what we believe is really based on Scripture, what are the texts that undergird and justify our wording? And I didn't feel. I mean, you even now read those texts and see if you get our statement out of them. You know, I think that we're weak.
So let me ask a clarifying question then, Larry. Do you feel that the statement as it reads on it, is it the list of texts that's the bigger issue, or is it the statement itself? So do you think the statement that the fundamental belief as it reads, is it number 24 or 18?
I think it's 24.
24? So as it reads, Larry, do you feel that it's a true biblical statement that is just lacking or weak in regards to the list of texts we use to support it?
Well, it seems to me like we have a statement of traditional belief and then we went looking for support.
Mercy.
That may be unfair because, of course, our pioneers looked at Daniel, you know, as they were trying to figure out what went wrong when 1844 didn't happen and so forth. You know, I wasn't there in the beginning. I don't know what all happened, but, and I don't think that there was anything nefarious going on in 1980, you know, in the General Conference session that voted it. I think everybody was doing his or her best, I guess his best. There were no hers involved, which also is an interesting thing to observe.
We don't have time, Larry. We don't have time.
So, I mean, Sean asked a pretty big question, but I need to follow up on this because what you've just described is the text that we have would not necessarily, at least in your opinion, result in a statement like what we have right now. If you don't mind me asking, are there significant areas of disagreement that you feel like you have, or at least areas where there's enough need for clarification that it creates a, like, this isn't something I'm comfortable that this isn't something that I'm comfortable with that is included in this statement?
You know, subsequent to this, the General Conference appointed a sanctuary committee, the doctrine. And it went on for years. I don't know. I don't think it exists any longer, but I think it went on 25, 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And those questions that we had in 1980 still weren't resolved to most people's satisfaction. So my view is that we have a problem with that doctrine, with the sanctuary doctrine. It's problematic.
And this is uncomfortable because it's not only what happened with Desmond Ford, but I don't know if you agree with this statement, Larry, but is there any other central fundamental belief or teaching within the church that is exclusive to Adventism?
No, I think this is thought to be our main contribution.
And that makes it pretty uncomfortable if it's our main contribution and we don't have our act together with what it actually is and the texts biblically that back it up. That makes things pretty uncomfortable. And I think that's our felt experience. The reality is, Larry, I think you're right that there's something off because look at the fruit of how we just don't know. Like, I don't know about you, Jesse and Anthony. I just felt like I didn't know what this was growing up. I remember basic things being taught about it, but it just never felt like I could wrap my head around it. Even in undergrad, like studying religion and theology, like, what is this? You know? And that just seems to be many people, pastors, teachers, employees of the church, their felt collective experience with the doctrine. Why is that?
If you look at the crises in the church, most of them have resolved around these issues, you know, the Brinsmead, the predecessors to them, people left the church. Some have been asked to leave the church, and most of the issues seems to revolve around this doctrine.
And it's kind of described in a way that if you reject pieces of it or have at least sincere questions about pieces of them, then you have kind of fallen away from the truth, which is really intriguing. So I guess I'm really curious then, going into 1980, the fall or late summer, going into Glacier View, was this 20 belief 24 and the wording of it, was it of significant usage in the conversation at Glacier View? And for those who aren't familiar, this is where there was a big, I think it was at least over 100 scholars and administrators coming together in Glacier View to process through Desmond Ford's, what he had come out with, that was
his arguments, basically.
Yeah, taking to task some elements of the sanctuary that he thought weren't biblical. And so I'm just curious, was this a major usage moving forward, or is it something that maybe more recently has become a kind of set in stone, concrete thing?
I think that, the discussions that we had in 1980 during the committee that came out with this, and we were not really satisfied with it, I think contributed in a way to Desmond Ford had he had studied extensively and felt that he had the answer to a lot of the issues that were being discussed. And those came up in his document that he prepared. And at Glacier View, there was certainly a divide. In my view, most of the professors, the people who knew the biblical languages and who had taught them and so on, agreed that Ford was closer to the truth on the matter than he was a renegade, whereas the denominational officials, the people who were presidents and secretaries and treasurers, you know, they were very comfortable, or at least said, we've got the statement, it's on our fundamental beliefs, it was voted at GC session, and so that's what we have to stick with, you know.
Oh, really? So this did play a role? Yeah. In the sense that this is already out there, we can't track it back.
We can't backtrack because it's been voted.
Right, right.
Whoa, yeah.
And I don't know that that was the prevailing or main reason. Mm-hmm. I think there was a genuine attempt on the part of many people at the Glacier View to take more time to deal with these issues, you know? More time than had been taken at the GC session. The consensus statement that I know that Fritz Guy and William Johnson were two people who were involved in that consensus statement. And there was a bait and switch at the end. What they came up with was not what was published, you know.
Okay, wait.
Really?
Say more about that.
And that I was not, you know, that was after the conference happened. but yeah, I wished I wish that Fritz and Bill were alive right now to discuss that, because I'm
lost
not
both of them.
I wasn't personally involved in what happened afterwards. There are people, you know, that might be good to talk to. I'd be glad to share some names with you if you.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Fair. That's fair. Yeah.
So yeah, wow. So there's a lot to this, and one thing I hear you consistently saying is that you didn't feel like there weren't nefarious right. intentions in a lot of this. But I do right. hear you suggesting that a lot of things like time pressure, the perceived response of the members of the SDA Church, or at least the delegates there at the conference, at the GC session, would have, and just the
fear of backtracking.
Yeah, the fear of backtracking, but also just the inability to within those time constraints, be able to find some level of consensus that could create a pathway moving forward, resulted in much of what we're dealing with now. Is that
yeah,
fair?
Yeah, because administrators have a legitimate desire to keep people together and to stick with what's been decided and not to rock the boat. And mm-hmm. let's go with this, you know, whereas scholars say, we believe in unity and so on, but it's got to be based on something that's accurate, something mm-hmm. that's truthful, something mm-hmm. that we can defend, mm-hmm. you know. And so there's that, always that tension between people who are responsible for keeping the group together and the people who study in depth and aren't so worried about, you know, keeping everybody together. They want the truth.
Yeah.
And so that tension is just always there. And it comes out when there's somebody who raises their voice and makes a big point mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. print or in holding meetings. And then the people who are overall administrators, they get nervous. Here's a dissident. Here's somebody who's mm-hmm. causing mm-hmm. trouble. They may mm-hmm. be divided mm-hmm. church. So let's tamp that down. So, most people, I think, are of goodwill and want to be supportive and do the right thing, but your instincts are different depending on your experience and your training and your responsibilities in the church.
Can I ask I don't know if this is an uncomfortable question, but you said most people have good intentions. And you also said, at least specifically at the 1980 GC session, it seemed like there was nothing nefarious going on. But when you talk about Glacier View, you mentioned some sort of bait and switch, and you wanted to withhold, maybe since you weren't there, for a firsthand account of what happened. Just from what you heard, maybe you weren't there in that moment, but from everything that surrounded Desmond Ford, from what has proceeded from administration, this idea of this tightrope walk where you're trying to preserve unity, but you're also trying to be truthful. Mm-hmm. Do you think there was was there a sufficient enough amount of evidence for administrators to see this isn't enough? This isn't good enough. This is going to cause confusion. It's not biblically based enough. And there was some sweeping under the rug that was a bit intentional, not just a genuine, like, oh, we just had to go with it, but pushed, in your opinion, went past that line of, hey, we're trying to keep unity and actually suppressing and limiting what could be done.
I would say that did not happen at the GC session, but I think it may have happened at Glacier View.
Yeah.
There were people there. And there was a background to Des Ford in Australia with people who had taken sides. In fact, that's why he was teaching at PUC instead of Avondale. I mean, the division wanted to sort of get rid of him, and so he was getting a new chance. And so his detractors in Australia continued that process. And at Glacier View, they were very evident. And so it Glacier View was a lot more political than the general conference session, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so being involved in a fundamental belief process,
formation process.
What, you know, you had mentioned previously that we've always tried to be really careful about creeds. As Sean was saying, it kind of practically has become a creed to a large degree now. But was it pretty evident along the whole conversation that this wasn't necessarily we got to get our beliefs down so that, you know, we have a way to judge everything, but that was it primarily stated that this was for others outside of the church, or was it just kind of like an assumed thing by most?
I think at the GC session, most people, I think, were thinking of it as this is what we believe. We want to hash this out and come to an agreement so that there's no questions about if you're an Adventist, this is what you believe. And it was not so much for the world to find out what Adventists believe, but it was to help administrators know who was in and who was out. I think that's would be fair to say.
That's pretty creedal.
But that's interesting because it seems like it conflicts with something you earlier said. And so I'm just curious about, was it the idea of some, including it sounds like some of the people who were at the seminary who were involved in this process, not so much to make a creed, but how can we explain our beliefs to outsiders? There's that crew.
That's how we viewed it at the seminary, those who were working.
Okay.
This is so when people said, what do Adventists believe? This is what the statement we want to come up with.
So it sounds like there's...
We teachers at the seminary don't have the task to keep the church pure or to hire only people who are going to be, you know, core and not cause administrators trouble and so forth. We were looking at it from the standpoint of what's defensible, what does scripture teach, how can we understand the sources, you know.
This makes me really curious because you have spent time as an administrator and as a scholar, and as you described, there can be different roles that each has in the life of a larger entity, and both are needed, have really good, really important roles. That being said, how did you, maybe on becoming an administrator, either deal with this or look back on all of this? And do you have a more intense judgment on the process looking back of saying, as an administrator, I recognize what they should have done? Or do you have more compassion on it of like, well, no, I get some of the tension here.
Yeah, I, having been an administrator at two institutions where issues have arisen, I certainly understand the feelings about let's keep things together and not rock the boat, you know. In my ministry, it's amazing. I've been at the center of several issues. I mean, there were the first gay camp meeting, there were three seminary professors who were invited to the camp meeting. It was Fritz Guy and Jim Cox and myself. To help gay Adventists look at the text of scripture and so on. And so, you know, mine was the Old Testament text and Jim Cox were the New Testament text. And then Fritz was from a theological, ethical point of view. And when it came to ordination of women, my sister-in-law was one of the first three to be ordained at Sligo, and she asked me to introduce her at the service. Mm-hmm. When my board chair found out that I was going, he forbade me to go. I mean, I was going to La Sierra. He said, "You'll lose all credibility in the church. The enrollment will go down. People will not want to send their students to, to La Sierra. And so I forbid you to go." I said, "You know, you're my boss. If this is a deal breaker, I'll quietly steal away. You won't have any, you know, fighting it from me. But I said, I have a word of the Lord, from the Lord for you too. I said, I understand you need to tell your colleagues you've labored with me and that you counsel me not to do this and so on. But I said, I have 2,000 students who are looking to see if the church is a place that's going to be for them as they get involved in their careers and families and so on. They want to know if it's a church that is open to diversity and cares and affirms everybody, or is this going to be a church that is just for white men, let's say, you know? And so I said, I'm going to the service. I'm going to introduce my sister-in-law, and it's for you to decide whether I continue on in my job or not. And to his credit, he never raised the issue again. I mean, I went. And there, you know, at the seminary, I was the advisor to the Black Student Association, and got into trouble for that too. So a lot of the issues in the Adventist Church, for some reason, I've been involved and have tried to play a constructive role, one that stands for what's right from my perspective and stands for truth, but trying to keep people together and moving forward rather than breaking up into disparate groups and so forth.
Yeah. So I'm assuming then that
Sorry, Sean, to interrupt briefly, Larry, I was going to say before you said it that you're a bit of a problem Adventist, it seems.
That's true.
Wherever problems crop up, there's Larry.
I can name you administrators who would sign on the dotted line to agree.
I'm sure. That would not surprise me.
So did you find that I was just jumping off of that with Anthony too, you know, to be in that space, you know, you've probably been labeled progressive liberal. You know, obviously there's the reputation in conservative Adventist circles of La Sierra itself. And I'm sure a lot of that's been attached to you as well. We don't have time to fully get into this, but after your full and long career, do you find that took away from your joy or zeal is a big word, but like, you know, just staying within Adventism, was there ever a point combined with the fact of what happened with Sanctuary, what happened at Glacier View, just the finding yourself in those challenging areas, did you ever feel like, man, maybe Adventism isn't it?
Another way to say this is you're still an Adventist despite it all. Yeah. Why is that?
Yeah.
Right. I think the worst time was driving away from Glacier View, you know, and I think there were many scholars who came away reevaluating their relationship to the church. And it took a lot of prayer and thought and discussion before many of us felt like we could continue, you know? But I'm, you know, I'm a lifelong Adventist. And as I became more distant from some of those issues, I could put those into perspective and see that it was a skirmish, but not a battle to the end, you know. And as you get older, you realize that that there's value to keeping the family together, and it's worth working hard to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, the church has been wonderful to me. It's given me my belief system. It's given me my job. It's given me interesting and challenging things to do. And my holiest times have been as a result of opportunities the church has given me. So I see great value in the church, and I'm not attracted to any other group of people more than I am the Adventist Church.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, it's interesting. My dad, who was a college president and an administrator, it's in the GC and so on. At the time when the Mary Kay issue was going on in Pacific Press, you know, and women were not being paid the same, my dad flew from Washington to San Francisco to support Mary Kay rather than the church's position that women should get less, because he believed it was important that equal pay for equal work and so on. And so I mean, I've had that example within my family. My dad was not theologically worried about things. He was a Catholic before he became an Adventist, and he just switched allegiances from the Pope to the church for the Adventist. And basically what the church taught was what he believed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when it came to being fair and equitable,
mm-hmm.
my dad was somebody who would say, progressive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we all, I presume, inherit certain tendencies from our families and from our experiences, whether it's in a church or in the immediate family. So we're affected by many influences around us. But my wife and I both grew up in the mission field, as I said, and we had very strong and supportive families where theological discussions were constant and typical.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I feel like I'm a very strong, loyal Adventist. But yes, I would say I belong to the progressive wing. I want to see the church succeed, but I value truth, and I think that I've been involved recently in another issue that's caused a stir. I don't know if you...
Come on, Larry. Another one?
I got him. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Reclaiming the Prophet.
Yeah.
Reclaiming the Prophet I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. Eric Anderson is the general editor of that, but the people that are involved are Terry Amott, Niels Erik Andreasen, Jonathan Butler, Dennis Fortin, Ron Grable, George Knight, John McAdams, Paul McGraw, Gil Valentine. So those are names of people who, while you probably most of them you'd call progressive, they're all solid Adventists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Professors and administrators and so on, but feel like we're going to lose Ellen White as a voice in the church unless we're honest about her ministry and her contributions, you know? So this book is an attempt to take an honest look and to acknowledge the tremendous asset that we've had with her ministry and so on, but not to claim things that you know, can't be claimed.
Wow.
That would be an interesting, like, Larry, I'd be interested in a follow-up conversation at some point with, you know, maybe even with some of those authors about, because we've been having a lot of questions over the past few months of not just Sanctuary. We've been in the series, but kind of what goes with that is, what on earth do we do with Ellen White? Like, we are growing more and more confused,
right?
I think, as a denomination. And frankly, us as friends, we've talked about this for a while. Mm-hmm. Just what do we do with her? And so I'm really interested. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book, but talking to more people, like you mentioned, one of the reasons people leave the church, of course, is the Sanctuary doctrine. But right alongside that is Ellen White.
Right.
And saying that we can't get to fundamental Adventist beliefs without the influence of Ellen White, whether she initiated it or not. There's just this argument. Yeah, we need Ellen White to be an Adventist. Mm-hmm. And so alongside a ton of other issues, right? People with, you know, the issue of plagiarism, contradictions, you know, just things that seem to not even make sense at all, certain things that she said. So yeah, I know that we're not going to get into that here, but I'd be really interested in just looking even more deeply at Ellen White.
Well, I am curious. Because you wrote a piece of this about Ellen White for Today. I am really curious about, I'm sure in your own experience here, when it comes to specifically the Sanctuary Doctrine here, much of Ellen White's role, as far as I have learned it, was as a confirmational presence in the whole process of the development. So Ellen White would have a vision following conversations and discussions about different doctrines, and would have a vision that affirmed, you know, a position that had been arrived at already. I'm really curious to, if you have any thoughts in that as well. I mean, obviously you guys were crafting an entire statement about this, and then to go to Glacier View following that and to do even deeper discussion, some of which, as far as I can tell, at least conflicts. Even like the consensus statement has some conflicting elements with the early Adventist conclusions. I'm not going into details on that, but just that's from my reading. Being someone who's looked deeply into Ellen White, someone who's looked deeply into the investigative judgment or the Sanctuary Doctrine as a whole, what are some of your insights into her role, into how we deal with her role to play in that, but also the continuing pursuit of truth over the course of our life? That, I mean, what happens if we find ourselves in conflict with someone from the past?
Well, I view her as a very key leader of the church. We wouldn't have a Seventh-day Adventist church if it weren't for Ellen White.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have the educational system, the medical, you know, ministry, the publishing ministry. All of those things we have to thank Ellen White for. I see her as being involved in the early views as they solidified in the church, but not as necessarily initiating or forcing anything, but she did come up with confirmation of what later has become, you know, Adventist belief and practice and so forth. So she helped to guide, and she was involved in the discussions early on, but I think played a very positive and unifying role in bringing things together. She wasn't perfect, as none of us are, but I think that her crucial role needs to be acknowledged and celebrated. But we can't, the church keeps going after she dies, you know? And so we have to say that lots has happened since then, and we don't have her alive to, as part of the discussion. New things have arisen. So who are our leaders and prophets for today that are, you know, continue to help us? We have to look for that. So I think she played a key but appropriate role in the development of the church. But we can't stultify at that point. We have to keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's an Adventist tradition that men and women both will continue to prophesy in the last days, right? So who are prophets today?
Amen.
You guys may very well be playing that role for many of us. So I applaud your interest and efforts to dig deep and to encourage more thinking.
I appreciate it. One more question here.
You
got
a follow up?
Yeah,
you do it.
So what do we do with, I really appreciate your words, but also, you know, we call our podcast Seeking What They Sought based off of a proverb that pretty much hints that it's not our goal to go copy whatever people said before us. It's don't do as the masters did, seek what they sought. So seek the same thing they were seeking. And
I when like we look, that.
Yeah, it's a Japanese proverb. When we look back at the founders of Adventism, we see this deep desire for biblical faithfulness. And so should that not be our continuing pursuit, you know, to
Absolutely.
This very day? The challenge that I think many people find with their own pursuit of biblical truth is that they'll come across the sanctuary doctrine and find pieces that they don't feel align well with the rest of the story of Scripture, or that feel sometimes downright contrived, or maybe even feel completely contradictory to the gospel, right? And so let's just say that those are some various responses that people have to the, especially the investigative judgment piece of the whole thing. What is the role of fundamental beliefs and their wording in someone's participation in the church, especially if there is a consistent disagreement with those belief systems? There's people that we know who have voiced their disagreement and have been asked to leave by their conference. I personally have voiced my lack of surety around, especially the investigative judgment piece of the sanctuary doctrine, and thankfully have had a lot of support from my local conference, not in so much that they are affirming affirming a different belief system as much as just saying it's okay to process through these things. And if anything, I think a conclusion that I've come to is something that you said earlier, is that I think it's less about if someone disagrees or agrees, and how much more so how are they approaching it? Are they going to be constructive about it? Or is it a downright attack on the church? Like, I think that all plays a factor into someone's role and involvement in the church. But without going into my views too deeply, I'm just curious about what your thoughts are on this. If someone were to say that they had some concerns or some questions or maybe even some disagreements explicitly with the doctrine laid out in number 24 of the fundamental beliefs, how would you describe what role the fundamental beliefs ought to play in their involvement in the church?
Well, I still like to see them as an expression of what most Adventists would believe. So it's opening ourselves up to a non-Adventist audience looking at us. And I would say, do I have to believe every single sentence in all of these beliefs? No, because that's a picture of what the majority of the Adventist church and its leadership have believed. But I'm not content with that. I want to grow. I want to learn more. I want to dig deeper. I want to make sure that it makes sense to me. And let's put this into perspective. Matthew 25 says what we're going to be judged by.
Yeah.
And none of the things that we've talked about here today.
Our presence. Yeah,
very true.
So, Part in our thinking and in our discussions, how are we treating each other? You know, that's important. More important, maybe even than, you know, where we come out on any certain issue.
Mm-hmm.
Have we cared about each other? Have we affirmed one another as children of God?
Mm-hmm.
are all human beings children of His? Mm-hmm. And do we care for all of them? And is there a place in the church for everyone who wants to be part of it, you know? Mm-hmm. Or are we trying to sort people out and say, yeah, you can't belong unless you believe mm-hmm. this way? So I guess I would like to see the church as a group of people who are still seeking, like your name implies, looking for what's true, what's worthy, what's helpful, what's affirming as children of God, and recognizing that none of us is perfect and that even the church doesn't have everything together mm-hmm. perfectly, mm. but I would hope that we can do it better. What we do have together is better and more defensible than any other group, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I can't be, and none of us should be content with what we have. We want something better. Mm-hmm. Let's keep looking, searching, you know?
Yeah. Wow. So, and we agree with that, Larry. I appreciate the way you articulated that. And it's our belief to keep pushing for that. We're still in the Adventist Church because we believe, like you do, like it's worth sticking by it. Like a lot of the mm-hmm. things that you shared a few minutes ago about why you're still in it through mm-hmm. all the ups and downs, like that resonates, I think, pretty deeply with the three of us. But just from an honest perspective, we're recording this on the heels of GC 2025, right? It's a very, you know, political, you know, potentially consequential time.
The heels would indicate after.
Oh, this after. Sorry. We are what is that? What's the phrase? We are
on the toes.
We're before
on the toes.
We're leading up to. We're almost there. We're almost there. Just less than a month away.
Right.
And when we look at that, do you feel optimistic about just genuinely when you look at the practice of our church, not just, you know, and I'm not taking away from what you said. I believe in the sentiment of what you said that we should do this. But when you look at the practice of our church, the way it's set up structurally, what's mm-hmm. actually happened, mm-hmm. do you feel optimistic about where our church is headed, at least as an organization? Yeah. There's always going to be grassroots people and even sub church, you know, local churches and other areas of the church that are doing good. But mm-hmm. at large, do you feel optimistic about the direction of our church currently?
Well, I'm concerned. I'm worried, to be truthful.
Yeah.
And I'm not somebody who affirms the current leadership mm-hmm. of the church. And I definitely think it's time for a change in leadership. And that has nothing to do with, you know, doctrine. It has to do with basic Christian love, respect, and inclusion. And there's a sentiment in the church right now that unless you believe and act the way leadership does, you just mm-hmm. don't belong, you know? And that they think we live in a time when it's good to cut people out, so that they're only the faithful and the true are left, you know? Mm. I think that that's worrisome for a worldwide church. So at the same time, I know that it's not easy. If you have 25 million people from around the world with different backgrounds and traditions and views and so on, holding them all together and moving forward is not an easy task. So I'm very sympathetic with the problem. But hey, this is this is God's, this is God's problem. It's not ours, you know? Yeah. And so whoever wants to be involved in helping to lead and be involved and to move forward, let's give them a chance, and let's give people the benefit of the doubt. And I guess I'm kind of person who would like to be more inclusive and let God take care of the edges, the people who need to be, you know, to leave. So how I feel about the church will be affected by what happens next month.
That's honest.
Yeah. Larry, as maybe we start winding down, I am curious. We've talked about a lot of things today. You've shared a lot about your journey as a part of the process of forming Fundamental Belief 24. And I guess just maybe circling back to something Sean mentioned earlier is it's such a sanctuary doctrine, such an interesting belief in that I think so many, just the lack of clarity that mm-hmm. I've heard as a pastorally, anecdotally, of course, but pastorally I've heard, even in doing Bible studies across all ages, I think the lack of clarity on what it is, what it's saying, what's the big idea, what's the big picture. And even for myself, circling back, you know, to what we were discussing a few minutes ago, I don't think it was until seminary where I finally understood what the big picture idea was. And that was in taking class from Dr. Richard Davidson and sitting with him outside of class for hours upon hours and agonizing over Hebrew and asking questions and saying, but why? And then finally getting to like, oh, I see, I guess I see what we're trying to say. And so I'm curious for you, you were heavily involved in this process. I know you've said not claim to be a theologian,
right?
But you are, you know, a history, Old Testament scholar and competent in your own right. I guess I'm curious for you, if you had to summarize, what are we trying to say with the sanctuary doctrine? What is it that, as an Adventist family, we see in the text from your perspective? And I know that that has changed and shifted. Even Dr. Davidson, probably he would articulate it differently today than he did 20 years ago. What do you think is this contribution? And I think that's kind of part of our heart as we're doing this series, is trying to drill down as Adventists, what are we saying to the world with this idea that we're seeing in the text? Yeah. What's the flag we're carrying into battle here? How would you articulate it for yourself?
Well, I guess based on scripture, we look forward to a time when the culmination of all things and a judgment will take place, you know, and people will have to make a choice between right and wrong, simplistically, but a picture of God, you know, who God is and what he expects. And I look forward to the judgment because I know that the person who gave his life for me is the one who's going to make the decision about whether I come along or not. You know?
Wow.
He's not going to forsake me now, having died for me, you know? And if I want to be with him in eternity, he's my man. So I can walk into the judgment confident. The lawyer who's arguing my case is Jesus. He's for me. He's not against me. There's nothing that I can do. I like Fritz Guy used to say, there's nothing I can do to make God love me more, and nothing I can do to make him love him less. You know, he's for us, not against us. So there is going to be a denouement at the end of time. Judgment's going to take place. I don't think 1844 has very much to do with any of it, except that our forebears thought that that was a significant date, and when it didn't turn out that Jesus was come there, they had to find some rationale or reason. I think they made a mistake. That's no problem. We all make mistakes. We can move on. What resulted from that mistake was a precious fellowship.
And you have no problem saying that you believe it was a mistake.
I was just about to say, I was like, oh, we're just dropping that take, right down here at the end. Yeah,
just a bit of a hot take. I know I used to be your pastor, but
yeah, no, I mean, God's people have made mistakes through the years often. Mm. And I'm prepared to say that this was one of them. But that doesn't mean that God cannot use us in that mistake to build something bigger and better. And
it's so interesting that you say that, because that's been one of my core things just about exploring any of our doctrines, is that there is a certain level of fear that we inherently have. I don't think it's a bad thing, but there's a certain level of fear that we inherently have, like, oh, if this is proven wrong, the foundation falls out. Yeah, and it's like, I just don't see it the same way, I guess. And I'm not even trying to say that I have a concrete position on this doctrine at this point. It's just that I just don't see it the same way. If this doctrine were to fall apart, at least in my practical experience of following Jesus and of preaching the gospel, nothing would change. So that's a really intriguing thing. So it's really interesting to hear you say something along those lines.
I think it's better to admit a mistake than to look for ways to justify yourself that just don't make sense to anybody, you know?
So I know that, Anthony, you said we were closing. I'm going to do this just because...
winding
but,
down.
But I have to.
Larry
I have
just dropped that on us.
The ramp.
Because this brings together the Ellen White conversation, the sanctuary conversation, because it's all, you know, when we talk about Ellen White, can she be a prophet, Larry, and have gotten things objectively wrong?
So now we're just going to open that one.
Now Sean's going
to we don't have to spend Pandora's a lot of time. I just have to add, because this is going to be the response, Larry, is, maybe 1844 doesn't matter, but if she got that wrong, then what means... Yeah. Does that discredit her from if she gets something wrong? Maybe just even keep it generic. If she gets something objectively wrong, does that mean she fails the test of a prophet?
And I mean, for those listening who don't remember, it was Hiram, right? It was Hiram Edson who had the vision in the field that connected 1844, and then she confirmed it. So she wasn't the initiator of the idea.
Yeah,
but
she's
still,
the initiator of any of these things, you know, the confirmation, right? No, I think that your question is, can a prophet make a mistake and still be led by God and be valuable? And I think we look back in history, you know, the New Testament and the Old Testament, were all those prophets perfect? No, many of them made mistakes. But that didn't mean that they weren't an important part of the building blocks that we build on as we move forward. So I think it's better to admit a mistake than to spend endless hours trying to justify and look for reasons why you were right, you know? Mm. But I may be wrong on that, but
yeah.
Thanks for being honest, though.
No, and Larry, we appreciate that. Yeah. It's because we're all still pretty young in our Adventist careers, like about a decade in, and the stakes have just been so high. They've been laid out as, if you say this about Ellen White, if you say this about a fundamental belief.
John, I thought you were going to say, because we're young in our Adventist career, we're not going to comment on that. Moving on.
Well, but that's the thing, though, is what Larry's dream is that we can have authentic seeking and studying of Scripture.
Right.
But the reality is there's a lot of don't ask, don't tell in Adventism.
Yeah.
Because of this. And so you've got a lot of pastors and administrators and teachers and employees that when it comes to any issue, we've been culturally taught to just don't say anything then. Like just kind of keep it under wraps. And that does not create a healthy community when that is how we operate. And we see the fallout of that, right? We had a conversation with Ryan Day. He left over Ellen White and Investigative Judgment. and there was no room for him in the version of Adventism he existed in. And his thrust, and many ex-Adventists' point, is that the majority of Adventism, there is no room for that genuine biblical seeking. And that when people look at us, and we've been told, you know, we're on the left coast, the west coast. Anthony, you're in Texas, but you're at a university,
but you're
right?
A product we're told of this place.
Yeah, you're a product. That we inhabit a very small section, a sliver of Adventism where, you know, whatever. People call it neo-Adventism. They don't call it authentic Adventism. And that's the reality of the church. But I don't know. That's kind of why.
We had one guest call it Adventism light.
Yeah.
Not the rest.
Yeah.
No, it's just interesting because you've been a scholar, Larry. And so, it you know, when some of us approach this, it's very easy for us to just be like, oh, this stuff doesn't, you know, like we don't see this. But how deeply have we or can we even look, you know, with the skill sets that we have in front of us? It's really intriguing to hear your perspective on this. And I know that there are other scholars who would disagree and have their opinions. I think that's also what makes this challenging, you know. But right. I just appreciate mm-hmm. your honesty about that because mm-hmm. there is, it is wild to me how many people, like we've, you know, I've voiced my feelings about this doctrine, my current feelings about the doctrine, and we've had a lot of really good conversation about this as a podcast, and it's so funny to hear, you know, a pastor come up to me in my own conference or from other conferences and be like, yeah, I don't know how you guys, I could never say that. It's like, but yeah, it ends up being a problem. But I just appreciate you saying that because I think we just need more willingness to hear, or we just need to hear more people express what they really think about it, right? Or like for or against a lot of this. But I also really appreciate the nuance of it, that like, let's say it was a mistake. If it's a mistake, it doesn't have to mean the end of everything.
Right.
It just means
right.
that like, okay, yeah, sure, that happened, but God has used it for good. And if not, if that's not the story of God consistently throughout scripture, humans did right. something that was not ideal, and then God uses that for good. Even though there are consequences to that, God still uses it for something good. And so mm-hmm. I definitely identify that is a possibility here. But yeah, again, I just want to say thank you for mm-hmm. Sharing that. I don't want to cut it short, Larry, but I also don't want to take up a ton of your time. And we'll have more conversations about this with others as well. And we'd love to have you back on the podcast to discuss some of the other stuff that we've talked about. But yeah, I just wanted to say so much how much I appreciate your expression of the overall story that happened with this doctrine, mm-hmm. Your own feelings, like even what you discussed about driving away from Glacier View and that being a moment where everything comes into question for you. Because I think probably all of us in the church have had a moment where you walk away from something and you're like, uh-oh, do I believe this? Is this, you know? And those are scary moments, but it's really cool to hear someone who has had the story you've had of deep in Adventism from birth, as well as having these questions, but then saying, I can remain faithful to a family and mm-hmm. invest my life here constructively. And so it's just a really cool story overall. I just want to say thank you so much for sharing it.
And I'd just like to echo that, Larry. I think you sharing your perspective, your experience within the church, and then also sharing those of the likes of Fritz and also Bill Johnson as well, I think I will share personally that my time at La Sierra was a very formative time. For those who don't know, I was sharing, Larry and I were sharing earlier, I used to be Larry's pastor at La Sierra University Church, which is an honor. We didn't get much FaceTime back then because I was a youth pastor.
Right.
But I think my time at La Sierra was very formative because it showed me that the table was wider than I had previously thought, that I could wrestle with questions, really deep doctrinal theological questions, and still remain Adventist and still be a part of the family. And people like you, like Fritz, like Bill, who I got the chance to meet, both of them. Fritz used to, every time I would preach for first service, he used to come up to me afterwards and make a comment or point out how my Greek was incorrect. So I'm very grateful. Thank you for being who you are and sticking around.
Yeah,
I appreciate the time that you guys invest in this podcast, and wish you the very best. You're definitely on the right track, and God can use and will use people who are open to his leading and who haven't made up their minds on everything yet, you know.
Well, yeah. I really appreciate it. Thanks again, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
And we're looking forward to talking to you more another time. So
very good.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Appreciate it.
Hey friends, you've just been listening to another episode of Seeking What They Sought. I'm one of your hosts, Anthony Leiter, and on behalf of all the guys, we just want to say a big thank you to all of you who have come alongside us in our journey to have honest conversations about Adventism. We appreciate each one of you. As usual, if you haven't already, give us a follow on Instagram. It is kind of like our home base, social media-wise, and if you'd like to stay up to date on the episodes that we're posting or just different things that we're doing, you can follow us there. We're also kind of like low-key a meme account, and we post silly videos and other stuff, so give us a follow. We would love it. Also want to say a big thank you to our patrons, and we're really grateful to each one of you for helping us make quality content. So to each one of you, a big thank you, and if you'd like to follow us on Patreon, you can. There's a link in our Instagram bio if you'd like to support us. Thank you so much. Last but not least, if you could you leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen, because it really helps us actually in the algorithm to help new people get their eyes on the podcast. So if you could just go in, give us a little, hopefully a 5-star review, but you know, be honest, that really helps us just in the algorithm, the way that, you know, these things work these days. So we really, really appreciate it. All right, I think that's it for now, friends. So we will see you next time on Seeking What They Sought.